It was interesting to come into a story midway, kind of come into the middle of an event. We assume we know the details leading up to it, but sometimes we don't necessarily know maybe as much as we should in that particular moment. We have this man named Naaman, but you know, when we come into something midway, it can be disorienting. We may not necessarily know what we're trying to accomplish or even understand the details of. I always kind of remember, I remember there was a moment where I was in the family room of my parents' house and I was focused on whatever was in front of me. Some game, some distraction, there was lots of things going on in my head. But in vague memory, there was my mother and my sister having a conversation not 10 feet away at the dining room table. It was not a part of the conversation. I was mentally completely disengaged from it. I was very focused on what I was doing. And in the midst of it, it occurred to me that I was thirsty, so I got up to get a drink. And I passed in front of my mother and my sister, and at that moment, my mother looked over at me and said, "And he's doing it just as much as all of them. It's driving me crazy." And she pointed to the bathroom. And I looked at my mother, and I looked at the bathroom, and it occurred to me that I had no idea what I was at fault for, but I knew it had something to do with the bathroom. So for the next 2 weeks, I refused to go to the bathroom on the same floor as my mother. So she was in the kitchen, I went upstairs. It was the middle of the night, I went downstairs. I didn't know what I was doing wrong, but I knew eventually I'd make it right, even if I had to just avoid going to the bathroom altogether. You know, it's one of those moments where we should know the greater details of the story. We have Naaman. We plunge into the River Jordan 7 times. That's the opening line of today's reading. But who is this Naaman? Who is the details? And why did we jump into the River Jordan? There's always that question. Kings actually explains the whole thing. We're literally coming to the end of the story here without reading the beginning. Naaman was the third most powerful man in the Assyrian Empire. At a time, the Assyrian Empire was the most powerful nation on earth. I mean, sure, the Babylonians wiped them out, and someone else wiped out the Babylonians, and we can talk about history as it progresses, but at this time, Naaman, the Syrian, was the third most powerful man in the Assyrian Empire. A military general, a fearsome power in his own right, and then he was afflicted with leprosy. Doesn't matter how powerful you think you are, you can still get diseases just like anybody. And the ruler of the Assyrian Empire sought out every healer he could, sought out every prophet he could, sought out everything in his entire power to restore Naaman to not having leprosy. Leprosy's a death sentence. Because lepers had to live in their own communities, they had to live in their own colonies, they were completely cut off, they were so contagious that there was always the concern that they would spread everywhere that they were, and so there was this kind of death that occurred even before leprosy ever took their life. Leprosy was a far slower thing, but the fact that you had to leave behind your family, your job, your everything the moment you discovered you had it kind of ended any life you had before that. In that sense, it was kind of a death sentence. If you happened to travel somewhere and you were a leper, you had to shout unclean, you had to wear a bell, you had to completely segregate yourself and distance yourself. It was this killing disease. I mean, even today, we don't really cure leprosy. I mean, we have drug therapy. We can force it into remission. People can live fulfilled lives, but we still actually can't specifically cure leprosy. It is a terrible, terrible thing to be afflicted in such a way. And the other challenge is it's a visible skin disease. So not only do you have leprosy, but everyone can tell just by looking at you. It's this visible thing that cuts you off. And Naaman is facing this death. And so the king, the ruler of Syria, he finally makes that call out. He mentions in his court, he says, "Is there no one anywhere who can do anything to stop this?" And one servant, captured from the nation of Israel, says, "Oh yeah, my God can. There's a prophet in Israel. He could do it." So Naaman knows what he has to do. He has to travel to this little backwater country in the middle of nowhere that isn't even worth conquering in the Assyrian eyes, so they haven't even turned their sights towards it yet. Don't worry, later they do. They take out the nation of Israel, and Judah is all that's left. And they head down there. They find the king in Israel, and they say to him, Naaman confronts him and he says, "I hear you have a prophet who can cure me. I want to meet him." The king of Israel thinks it's a trap. He does. Because if he says no, because it's leprosy and he knows there's no cure for leprosy, then the Assyrians have a reason to go to war. And if he says yes, and the prophet doesn't cure him, well, then he still has leprosy and they still have a reason to go to war. So either way, Israel knows, the king knows that he can't stand against the Assyrian Empire. And he despairs. He doesn't really know what else to do. He didn't trust enough in God either. But Elisha the prophet hears about Naaman coming to Israel. And he sends a messenger and he says, yeah, I can cure. And so Naaman goes to see this great prophet, who, by the way, lives away from Jerusalem because he doesn't get along with the king at all. And so he lives in this little mud hut in the middle of nowhere. And I love this imagery of Naaman, this great Assyrian going down to this little backwater mud hut. And we might think of it as a one-on-one confrontation, but that's really not how it goes down. Naaman travels with an entire command retinue. It's an army all by itself. They travel in massive chariots and this big command retinue. Why don't you imagine like the President of the United States coming to visit someone personally in a really exciting place. Let's say Franklin Grove. Nothing against Franklin Grove, it's just not terribly large, so it kind of equates well. So imagine the President has to go down to visit and meet with someone in Franklin Grove. It's a lot more like that. There's this huge train that travels with Naaman. He travels with captains of the guard and personal bodyguard and cooks and chefs and servants and all the food that they need to travel with, because there's no McDonald's along the way, so they have to bring it all with them wherever they go. So there's this massive train that they go along with, and they stand before this unremarkable little hut of a madman. That's what prophet translates to, this crazy person. So they stand in front of a little mud hut of a madman, and Naaman wants to see him so that he can know what it's going to take. And Elisha won't see him. He sends out a servant. Go jump in the river 7 times. And Naaman is insulted. He's angry. He has traveled all this way. He is the third most powerful man in the Assyrian Empire. He is, by every regard, one of the most powerful people on the planet that they know of. And this little prophet won't even give him the dignity of coming out to see him. And he tells him to jump in some boring river. A river that most of the nation Israel uses to wash and clean. And it's not an impressive river. It's not a bad river, don't get me wrong. I've talked to people about it. It's a simple, muddy river. It's no mighty Mississippi, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's nothing impressive, but it's not a bad river. Naaman's seen the greatest rivers in the world, and he doesn't care for it. And he's about to go home angry, possibly contemplating going to war with the nation Israel because this prophet has insulted him. And his captains of his guard approach him and they say, now wait a minute. If he had told you to cross the globe through burning deserts and freezing tundras and to some impossible task, you wouldn't have thought twice about it. If he had told you to slay a dragon, we don't know where the one is, but if he had told you to slay a dragon, you'd go find one. If he had told you to do some impossible task of Herculean effort, you would have tried it. But because he tells you to jump in a river 7 times, it's not worth your effort. Man, imagine if I just asked him to come to church once a week for an hour. Probably scream at me. I know, it's terrible. Finally, he says, you know what, you're right. I would do an impossible task. I suppose I could jump in a river. And so he does. And that's where we pick up the story. Naaman, this powerful man, was about to go home angry because God didn't do it the way he wanted him to, because God's prophet didn't do it the way he expected him to, because it didn't happen on his terms. Suddenly, he's not sure he should do it at all. But he fulfills that simple task. And he jumps in the river. And he comes out and his skin is made new, like that of a new child. This beautiful innocence is restored. And Naaman doesn't think, wow, the River Jordan has magic properties. I should set up a spa. I could charge $100 a head. He doesn't say, my goodness, must be the sea air.
Must be the Dead Sea salt kind of coming up that Jordan dumps into the Dead Sea. Maybe we can just, you know, kind of capitalize on that. Maybe it's just the right combination of all these things. He doesn't even say, wow, the king of Israel should be praised. No, he goes back to the man who insulted him because he wouldn't come out, because it didn't happen on his terms, but it didn't happen the way he wanted it to. And he goes back to that prophet and he says, now I know that this is the God I need to worship. Because he can do what no one else can. I want to reward you, the prophet. He says it to Elisha, he says, allow me to give a gift to you because there is no God in all the earth except here in Israel, and I want to give you something. I will give you anything that you want. Think about this for a moment. The third most powerful man in the entire known world has approached you and said, I want to give you a gift, whatever you want. I want you to remember that Elisha looked him in the eye and said, you know, I'm good. I don't really need anything. I'm set. I have God. That's really all I need. And Naaman wants to show us gratitude. He isn't mad that the gift is rejected because that wasn't the point. He wants to show us gratitude. He wants to witness how important being restored truly is. And so he says, let me have some dirt. Which struck me as odd for a long time. What's he supposed to do with dirt? Seems like a strange thing to ask for. Two mule bulls. It's a fair amount of dirt. Several cubic yards at least. So that I can worship this God wherever I go. Because I want to offer sacrifice of thanksgiving to this God and this God only for the rest of my life. You see, he knew that this was the God he wanted to worship. And he believed, like everyone did at the time, no offense to Naaman the Syrian, that he needed dirt from the nation Israel in order to do that. Because he thought that God lived on that land. It's a common belief, everyone believed at the time, so nothing against him particularly. Of course, we've completely transcended that. It's not that we think that God lives in one specific place anymore, right? So we don't. It's not like we have to sit in one specific pew or go to one specific priest or go to one specific church. I mean, we've transcended all that, so, you know, that's not a struggle anymore. So that's good. But he wants to show his gratitude. It's incredible. Here's the thing. I've never been cleansed of leprosy. I've never been diagnosed with leprosy, so I don't really have the concern where I have to run around chasing a mule filled with dirt, so I can thank God every day for being restored to it. But I have been restored to Christ. And the restoration of my soul and the possibility of salvation and all the great gifts that God has given us in our life is so much more than just a healing of leprosy. You know, when we look at the things that God has given us in our lives, we consider the incredible gifts that he has given us. From our families. Remember, we don't get to pick our families. It's not like we got to stand up one day and said, no, I don't want that sister. No, I don't want that brother. I'll take that one. Maybe that cousin, that aunt. The rest just throw out. We didn't get to pick them. Some drive us crazy. Some of us make us crazy. But they're all gifts from God. But we didn't actually get to design our future spouse. We get to meet them. You get to say yes or no to, you know, committing your life to them. That's wonderful. It's not like you got to design them, though. Unless you're telling me you grew your spouse in a lab, in which case I'm a little concerned, and by all means tell me later so I can apologize to you. But when we consider the gifts we have, the talents that God gives us, the family that God bestows upon us, the spouses and friends and relationships that God has brought into our life, are we really grateful? Do we live that gratitude? Are we cultivating an attitude that actually shows how much it means to us that God has given us these remarkable gifts in our life? That God has offered us the many things that have brought us to where we are? Do we show our gratitude? I mean, you're here, so obviously something has struck a chord, or maybe somebody dragged you. Either way, you're here, so there is that witness to that faith. But are we doing that every day? Are we committed to this? You know, for Naaman, it was so important to him that he actually took the dirt with him so that he could continue to offer that thanksgiving to God, even though that's not like his life immediately changed in every single way. It's not like every problem of his went away just because he didn't have leprosy anymore. It's not like suddenly the whole world was transformed and all it was rainbows, roses, and sunshine. I can tell you, because we have historical perspective, Babylonians come and they wipe out the Assyrians. It's entirely possible Naaman lived to see that happen. It's not that everything became perfect after that. But he still committed himself to showing his gratitude to God forever. Jesus restores 10 lepers, brings them back to their lives. But it's the Samaritan who actually remembers that he's supposed to go back and show that gratitude, to express how much it means to him, to express how very near and dear and important it is to him that he has been given this great gift from God. At the end of each day this week, I want to challenge you. And when you say your prayers, when you come to the prayers at the end of your day, are you witnessing gratitude to God? Do you see where God has given you things and take the time to thank Him? Do you live it in such a way that you witness that life and actually take time to show that the gifts that you have been given are not wasted, but genuine gifts that you want to be grateful for? Can we show our gratitude this week? Even if you're not here to leprosy, can we still show the gratitude for the things that He has given? Or are we still focused on what we don't have?